It's a funny place to be, stuck in a seemingly mundane world with an inner knowing that the universe is so much more than our mortal minds can comprehend. Yet we all have the capacity to know peace and our oneness with the wholeness of life. And through these interviews, discussions, and reflections, it is my intention to share this possibility. I'm Ryan Kurzak, and this is the Kriya Yoga Podcast.
Yeah. Well, anyway, well, I'm here with Phil. And Phil is a longtime Kriya Yoga practitioner and also a Kriya Yoga meditation teacher, a student of Roy Eugene Davis. So we share that lineage. And I met Phil many years ago, probably over 10 years ago now. And we haven't been in touch a whole lot, but I do feel like we became good friends when we finally met and shared a room together at the Kriya Yoga Conference, and you put up with my snoring.
Oh, that's right.
But anyway, I wanted to have Phil on this podcast because I know that he is dedicated to this process, and I know that he has a lot of experience, not just with Kriya Yoga, but with spirituality and mysticism in general. And one of the things that we discussed before we got started was that Phil starts with teachings related to Christian mysticism, and that's the context that he comes from. And then should individuals finally come to a sense where they want to explore things like Kriya Yoga, he lets it develop from there. So anyway, I want to say thank you, Phil, for joining me on this podcast. And what I'd like to ask of you, first off, how did you get interested in Kriya Yoga? Because you come from a military and a Mormon background, correct?
Correct.
So how did that come into your awareness?
Boy, it's I'll try to be brief. It's a little bit of an involved story. I grew up in the Catholic Church, went to Catholic schools, and when I graduated from high school, I just didn't find Catholicism to be very soul nourishing. And I was in college initially about 1968, 69. And so it was in California. So it was kind of the Vietnam hippie era. And I had always been interested in what people believed and why they believed what they believed, and then how their beliefs impacted their daily living. And so after I stopped going to Catholic Church, I spent about 2 years just exploring every variety of church that I could, mainly Christian churches, but I studied with Christian Scientists and Jehovah's Witnesses, and there was a hippie girl named Lark that lived behind me. She was into Buddhism and Buddhist meditation, so she invited me over one day. And again, the culture was black lights and psychedelic posters and incense. Right. So I went into her room, and it was dark with these black lights on, and she had incense burning, and she forced me into the lotus posture and then gave me some instructions. And that was my first experience with meditation, and it didn't take long before I got all these spasms and cramps in my knees and hips. The incense created nausea. Then I got a headache, and I finally said, "Lark, I appreciate your effort here, but this is killing me." And I just got up and left. And I left with the conclusion that Eastern spiritual practices were not for me. So I kind of dove back in looking for some avenue in Christianity that would be spiritually nourishing.
Right.
In any case, after 2 years of exploring virtually every Christian denomination on the planet, I ended up joining the Mormon Church, served a mission in Brazil, and then was hired by the church to do religious education programming. And I did that for about 8 years. I was the campus minister at Auburn University and the University of Georgia. I was so successful at doing interfaith ministries, I was recruited into the chaplain service, and I served as an active duty Air Force chaplain for 21 years from 1984 to 2005. Mm-hmm. And then following that, I served as a hospice chaplain from 2005 to 2012. So I was always involved. My whole life was involved in essentially professional Christian ministry.
Right.
One sort or the other. And as you're a military chaplain, you do serve interdenominationally and so forth.
Right. So you always did have a sense of broad-mindedness about religions and spirituality.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I spent 37 years in, you know, Christian ministry of some sort or the other. I always struggled with issues related to biblical interpretation, traditional Christian teachings about the nature and character of God, about the meaning of Jesus, and so on and so forth. What troubled me year after year, particularly in the Christian counseling that I did, was people were not changing at the core level. Mm. There wasn't a transformation of heart and mind where people could be as Christ-like as they wanted to be. Mm. And that just always tormented me, that a person could work. I mean, here I am, you know, decades of professional Christian ministry, really wanting to be a more spiritual person, a more Christ-like person, but yet continuing to struggle with my character weaknesses and selfishness and inability to love fully. And I can remember going home to my wife one day after a week of frustrating counseling where people just didn't seem to have the power to change their hearts
right. In
a more loving way. And, you know, I was complaining that this, you know, Christianity, I just don't see working at the core level. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, how's it working for you? And, you know, she very kindly but honestly said, look, you've been struggling with a lot of negative qualities for many years doing this full time. It doesn't seem to be working for you very well.
Is she Mormon?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, my wife fell out of heaven. She's always had a pure heart and a pure mind, and she just always does the right thing out of intuition and didn't need a lot of improvement. I needed a lot of improvement.
Well, I remember you telling a story, and it might have been at one of the, maybe you were giving a talk at CSA, but I remember you telling a story about how you started meditating, and your wife mentioned to you that you weren't getting as upset as you used to, and that was one way that she was helping you see that it was actually working. Does that sound?
Yeah, it's actually more comprehensive than that. What had happened was was soon after she and I had that initial conversation, I suffered a serious injury to my neck, back, and shoulder.
That's right. Yes.
And the doctors didn't diagnose it properly, and so I was in a state of chronic pain for about 2 years. And, I mean, it was debilitating, and I was in pain so much that it just burned out my nervous system. And then I was suffering with anxiety and depression, and, I was lucky to get to work, each day. And I turned to meditation primarily for chronic pain management and stress relief.
Right.
So I started with, Jon Kabat-Zinn's book Full Catastrophe Living, which was his program of essentially mindfulness meditation and hatha yoga practices at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Mm-hmm. And that was my last ditch effort for survival. And as it turned out, those practices really helped me. And so the only time I got relief from those horrible symptoms was actually when I was meditating and doing mindful hatha yoga. And so because of that, I was practicing 3 times a day and logging many, many hours in meditation. Soon, several months into that, I ran across a Deepak Chopra program that I listened to, really liked it. So I took his mantra meditation course and then switched from from mindfulness meditation to yoga mantra meditation. And that really, really worked well for me. And two things happened. Number one, I was able to get management of the pain and other troublesome symptoms. And then number two, much to my surprise, a whole new dimension of spiritual realization and experience began to open to me that I had never experienced before. And so because that had been so successful, I started to go to the Chopra Center for training and started training to be one of his meditation teachers, not knowing that he, people don't know this because he writes in kind of a modern vernacular, but he really is a teacher of Vedanta and a practitioner of yoga. And so I was really being instructed in the, you know, the essentials of the yoga tradition. And I did that Chopra mantra meditation for 5 years. Well, about 3 years into that was when my wife said, "There's something going on with you." And I said, "Well, what is it?" Because it was happening so slowly, I wasn't recognizing it. And so she sat me down and she went through this long list of negative qualities that I'd been.
She had them written on a piece of paper somewhere just for that moment.
I don't think they needed to be written. They were things that she was working with me, you know, trying to help me improve to be a better person. And so she went through that whole list and she said, "This stuff has disappeared. Where did it go?" And I was incredulous. I was like, "Whoa, when did this happen?"
Right.
And then she went through a whole list of positive qualities that I had been working very hard to try to develop in my life, but with only marginal success. And they had just seemingly unfolded out of nowhere. Well, as we sat there reflecting on this, it dawned on both of us that it was obviously the fruit of my meditation practice.
Right.
Something inside was changing very deeply at the soul level.
But it was taking time. And the only reason I stress that is because I think many people expect there to be an almost immediate change. And what you described is that it took about 3 years and you didn't even notice it, right? It was because you were changing from your standpoint slowly, but someone external like your wife, she was the one that was able to kind of see this change, correct?
Absolutely. And of course, my initial focus was to manage pain and to get to work so I could retire.
Right.
And
the lofty spiritual goals.
I'll be honest with you. It's been my experience that most people experience deep spiritual growth as the result of some sort of trauma or major suffering in their life.
Right. And I took a note on that to get back to that, because I think that is something that many people don't pay attention to. So I've got that written down. We'll come back to that.
When I run across people that go into what I call the inner path, just out of devotion for God or seeking truth, I really admire these people, because it took unrelenting pain to drive me to serious inner work.
Right.
In any case, sometimes I'll tell people, you know, I noticed these kind of developments in 3 years, and they go, "Oh, 3 years, you know, they want something to happen in 3 months." Well, listen, in the context of I had spent 30 years in professional Christian ministry trying to be a better person and trying to eliminate negative characteristics unsuccessfully.
Right.
To have this unfold in 3 years, I mean, I experienced arguably 10 times the spiritual development in a tenth of the time.
Right.
So, yes, it's slow at one level, but in comparison to what I had been doing and to what most people are doing in religion, it's really miraculous, I think.
And you hadn't even made it to Kriya Yoga yet.
No.
Yes.
So this created a crisis for me. I had to sit back and say, "Holy cow, who am I? What am I? Am I a yogi guy or am I a, you know, Christian Mormon guy? I don't know who I am anymore." And I spent over a year trying to sort through, you know, who or what I was going to be. And because yoga had the yoga meditation practice had been so successful for me, I decided, well, gosh, if I'm going to be a yogi, I need to have some background, some expertise. And that's when I began studying the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, yoga sutras and so forth. And I was doing a meditation seminar up in Seattle, Washington. And during a break, went down to Powell's bookstore there and was going through the bookstore, and I ran across Yogananda's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So I purchased that, came home and began to study that. And I just immediately fell in love with Yogananda. His teaching, his spirit, his writing style, his focus, his deep, deep, deep passion and love for God, life, truth. I mean, I was just really overwhelmed by that spirit and presence, and then just the substantive nature of the teaching. Well, then, as I was doing that, I ran across his commentary on the Gospels, and that really began to bring my Jesus world and my yoga world together.
Okay.
So at that point, I was working as a hospice chaplain, and which is work with people that are dying.
Yes.
And I used to read from the New Testament, so I was reading a New Testament passage to a gentleman, and it was the passage in Matthew where Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and you will find rest unto your soul." Well, I knew that from my yoga studies that word yoke came from the same root word as yoga. And I'm not exaggerating what I say, that in 1 second, my vision of Jesus, what he taught, what his life meant, and my yoga world completely harmonized.
Right.
And I suddenly realized the depth, the true teaching, the true purpose of the life of Jesus, and it was completely harmonious with yoga. So that kind of solved my identity crisis. I realized I could be a true follower of Jesus when his life and teachings was understood at the mystical level, and that it was perfectly in harmony with yoga. And I actually wrote an article called The Yoga of Christ.
I remember that. Do you have a link to that I could maybe put in the, for people to see, or is it just only in print?
It is in print. We'll have to find a way to make that available.
Yeah, if you can, and I'll go ahead and I can put it in the liner notes so people can access that. Because I do remember, I remember either you sent it to me, but I remember reading that. I remember it being very good.
And essentially, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutra, both of, there are verses in those two texts that summarize the whole spiritual awakening process in the twofold formula of God, communion, and non-attachment.
Right.
And I suddenly realized that the bulk of the teachings and the meaning and the message of Jesus can be very neatly put in those two categories. And that's what the article demonstrates, that inner contemplative life, as well as the principle and practice of non-attachment. And I discovered, to my surprise, the dozens and dozens of teachings of Jesus with respect to non-attachment.
Exactly, yes.
Literally every area of life. And so identity crisis solved. Now, as this began to unfold and I got deeper and deeper into the teachings of Yogananda, I'd read the autobiography of a yogi, and he has that chapter in there on Kriya Yoga. Well, boy, the way he describes it, I want that, you know? Mm-hmm. So not knowing anything else, I contacted Self-Realization Fellowship and began taking the lessons, what they call the lessons, the home study course, which is quite extensive. And I enjoyed taking those lessons. I had some difficulty with the practice of the techniques, and I don't want to be rude in any way, but Self-Realization Fellowship, much like the Mormon Church, is very rigid. doctrinaire. They don't like a lot of flexibility in things. They want things done one way, the right way. And if it doesn't work for you, it creates a lot of difficulty.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people feel that way, so I'm not sure. I think that's just a statement of how people might perceive that.
Yeah. And you know, I appreciate so much what they do as far as the publications and the teachings of Yogananda that are available. It's just when I interacted with members and monks of the fellowship, there was this very narrow, rigid perspective and point of view. They also, at that time, demanded a very serious loyalty oath to that organization as your only church. Mm-hmm. So I realized I wasn't going to be able to be initiated into Kriya Yoga.
Right.
Well, then I had this memory of ordering some booklets out of Yoga Journal from somebody who had been a disciple of Yogananda. Mm-hmm. I wasn't real tuned in with the writing style, so I had thrown all these things in the bottom of a box years earlier. And of course, that was Roy Eugene Davis.
A little too dry for you?
It was a little dry. And of course, once I got to know Roy and love Roy, I understood why he wrote the way he did. And from that point on, really appreciated his clarity, his technical accuracy. And of course, today I absolutely love his writings, but at first I didn't. And I love more of Yogananda's devotional kind of style. In any case, I went back and got those booklets and read through them. And then, you know, I saw a phone number. So I called Center for Spiritual Awareness. Willie answered the phone. I explained what was going on with me. She says, "Oh, you need to talk to Roy." Roy got on the phone. You know, I gave him my history and told him I was trying to understand Kriya Yoga and pursuing initiation and my frustrations. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. He said, "Okay, well, tell me your questions." Well, I immediately turned to some of the techniques of Kriya Yoga that I was having difficulty with. And he said, "Well, try it this way." And I said, "You mean there's just not one way?" He says, "Well, yeah, there is one way. It's the way that works."
Oh, that's good.
And so he gave me a variety of options on some of the core techniques. And that's what started my relationship with him. So I was calling him every couple of weeks to update what I was experiencing. He would give me tips. We'd chat for a while. And then he asked me if I could get out to Georgia, where I really couldn't. So he sent me a CD. It was a Kriya Yoga initiation CD. And was going to have me just kind of initiate myself at home. Well, that was at the time he was starting those Kriya Yoga congresses. And the first one was in 2006 in San Jose.
Right.
And when I realized that was just 3 or 4 months away, I just put the CD away and I thought, I'm going to that Congress and I'll be initiated in person. And that's what I did.
Is that where we met or was it later? Because I was at that Congress.
I don't know if we met there because I was staying by myself and I sat next to Beth Spencer, if you remember her.
Yeah, I remember Beth. Uh-huh.
So we kind of struck up a friendship, and I think we met the next year.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I it's like as though there was a point in my life where I did not know Phil, and then all of a sudden I did, and I don't remember how it happened.
Right. And once we were at retreats together, we kind of had a chemistry, a natural connection, a deep love for the Kriya Yoga tradition and an intellectual interest in the practices.
Right.
And so there was just kind of a natural development of friendship based on that devotion and interest. So,
right.
In any case, I started those practices. Now I have to admit, and maybe this will be helpful for somebody, I was so well established in my Chopra mantra practice and some of his other supplemental practices that worked so well for me. When I first started practicing Kriya Pranayama, it was awkward. It was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent at least 6 months working with that with only a few times of positive experience. And so much time was being eaten up, I was missing I was missing my regular experience of deep inner communion and
right.
so forth. And I finally got to the point where I was like, I'm giving this up. I'm going back to my old practice. And the day I decided to do that, and it'd been about 6 months, I started going back to my traditional practice. And then literally out of the blue, there was this flow of life force up the spine in a very natural way. And the whole Kriya Pranayama process just happened on its own without effort on my part. And it was so nourishing, so expanding. I was stunned. So it gave me the vision of what this could be. And from that point forward, it wasn't a laborious practice at all. So in hindsight, as I go back, I think I must have been overthinking it, overworking it.
Well,
too caught up in the technical aspects of it.
I think that might be a more common experience than most people admit. I mean, for myself, even though when I first got into meditation, Kriya Yoga was pretty much one of the first practices that I was introduced to. It was, I've told people, it was at least a year and a half to 2 years before I actually felt that circulation within the spine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, and I remember I was thinking, I just need to do it more. I need to do it harder. I need to do it, you know, longer, whatever it might be. And I had brought it up to Roy and he said, just relax more. And he said, if you need to, just try to imagine it at first. And so after he said that, to relax more, not to be so forceful with it, I mentioned, it was a year and a half to 2 years, then all of a sudden there it was. So I think that many people, when they first learn Kriya, you know, we have all these wonderful stories from Autobiography of a Yogi and so on, that it's just going to be this miraculous, magical experience from the very beginning, when really it's the work that, like the work that you had been doing as you were kind of cranking through the process, it was making the way or moving the obstacles for that experience to finally come forth, like a seed finally coming out of the ground. So I think it might be more common than many people want to admit.
I think you're probably right. And I do agree with the idea of some sort of inner purification, inner clearing going on that ultimately allows that to unfold into your awareness.
Right. One quick question I have for you, though. I don't know a lot about the Chopra process, but I think if I recall, it is like an inner light, an inner sound contemplation. Is that accurate?
Not really.
Well, never mind.
he teaches a classic yoga mantra meditation.
Okay.
But it centers around a birth mantra that you are given.
So it's like TM.
Yes, he came out of TM.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
And so he just developed his own mantra system based on birth mantras. And then he has some other techniques that have to do with sutra chanting in the chakras that was really very helpful, very helpful.
Right.
But I never, there was never any emphasis in the training or in the experience there of contemplating inner light or inner sound. He mentioned a time or two, you know, you might see a light in the spiritual eye, but he never taught it as a practice.
Okay. I remember hearing something about primordial sound contemplation. For some reason I associated it with,
it's called primordial sound meditation. And the mantra you get is your primordial sound.
I see. So that's the confusion. So it's not contemplating, like, say, Om, as they talk about in the sutras. It's what he's saying is that mantra that you get, that is the primordial sound.
Right. So he developed a system of sounds that supposedly reflect the vibration of the universe at the time of your birth.
Right. Yeah.
And so theoretically, by as you chant this sound, you're going back to the point where you were incarnated, and then that's a portal for you to pass into an expanded consciousness.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
It worked really well for me. I mean, it really did. Now, I'll say this. You know, Ken Wilber has a model called the 1-2-3 of God, and he describes how you can have a third person, second person, first person experience of God.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, third person sensing the divine in nature, in things outside of yourself. Second person being an experience of divine relationship where something in you is connecting very profoundly or communing with the divine. In the sense of deep intimate relationship, and then first person being the pure experience of oneness with and in God.
Mm-hmm.
And what I had experienced in my Chopra mantra meditation was second person experience and third person experience expanded, but it was primarily a second person intimate communion with God. What I noticed, the first thing I noticed after Kriya Yoga, Kriya Pranayama began to work well for me, I knew there was this realization of oneness out there. I mean, it was in the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading it in the Gita and the Upanishads. But obviously, I couldn't understand it in my mind. I thought the communion experience that I was experiencing was it, but I had a sense that it wasn't. And so, you know, I would struggle with what oneness meant trying to understand it in my mind. Of course, it's not understandable in the mind because the mind is dualistic in its processes, and you're, you know, describing an experience or realization beyond that. So the first substantive thing I noticed when I began serious Kriya Yoga practices was suddenly that realization, knowledge, and experience of oneness unfolded.
Okay.
In my soul, in my personal experience, and a level of comprehension of it in my mind.
Hmm. So with the level of comprehension of it in your mind, because you're describing this idea of communion, and the idea of communion is a sense of a bringing together of two things in a way. Is that accurate, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I experienced it in second person, because there was me and then there was this intimate experience of God that I'm experiencing in relationship. So that it's really a dualistic experience, but yet it's deep and profound and it has aspects of oneness to it.
Okay.
That was the basis for my initial inner transformation.
Right. And so after that, you actually were able to have the experience, which was beyond the mind, of this oneness. And again, since we're using words, it's going to come out somewhat dualistic because that's the best we got.
Yeah, well, it was the experience of pure, formless reality.
You're saying that it translated into your mind, though. So are you saying your mind was able to understand it, or you were able to put aside your mind such that you were able to simply exist in it?
Both. So at first I had the realization of it, and then there was a level as much as I guess is possible, there was a level of comprehension of it in my mind, because my mind went, oh, this is it, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Now, trying to explain it, forget it, it's extremely difficult, but yet my mind could grasp it to a certain degree, where before it was a mystery to me, an absolute mystery.
Okay, I see. Yeah, that's what I was getting at, because when I imagine having that experience relatable or understandable to the mind, my mind then goes to, oh, well, then you can obviously describe it. But what you're saying is you had the experience, and then your mind-body personality unit, it made sense within that. But of course, it's not necessarily something you could describe, which is the issue that most mystics have as well, correct?
Absolutely. And And again, in hindsight, you know, you look back to understand what you think was happening. This practice of moving life force, you know, Kundalini, Shakti, whatever you want to call it, the intentional practice of moving that up into the higher centers of consciousness and having a deeper purification, a deeper transformation, you know, in the brain, in the mind, that allows you to at some point have that realization. See, I attribute that to the Kriya Pranayama process.
And so with that, then, you know, this is something that one of my dear friends from Asheville, who's also a center for, he's a CSA minister, he would tell me, you know, no matter what, you can't talk someone into a higher state of consciousness. You can't talk them into it. But what teachers can do is say, okay, here is the process that allowed me to have this experience. I can't speak to you about it. I can't tell you about it, but I can say, do this, and then you'll see, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that was Yogananda's whole thing. You know,
right.
Do this. You know, he called it scientific, because if you follow these steps persistently and patiently, you'll get the result.
Right. Well, what do you do for people, though? I mean, because this is something that comes up a lot. When, you know, earlier on you mentioned this idea of God communion and non-attachment being described, or the passages in the Bible where this is very clear. And before we actually did this interview, you know, I had mentioned that I had begun reading St. John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul. And in that, him being a Christian mystic, there is this constant theme of one has to let go of essentially attachment to everything, even one's concept or hopes in God. You know, that dark night of the soul being when it seems as though God himself has forsaken you, but you even have to let go of that desire. Again, this has been a hard book for me to read, number one, because of sort of the language, that how it's written and the word usage, but also trying to comprehend what's being shared there. How have you found a way to impart to people, hey, this is how the process goes, and that you have to do it, but you also have to learn to let go of attachment to how you think it's going to go? Does that make sense, the question I'm asking?
It does. You do have to let go. I mean, it is the nature of the ego mind, even in spiritual things, to want to get control of the process.
Right.
And then you subvert the process by not letting the divine unfold and manifest. You know, you end up hindering the whole development. Now, I love the you know, the ancient Christian mystics. If I have complaints, and some of them, their teachings and practices are just so profound that, you know, you just have to honor it. But I saw two issues with those guys, Number one, there was this overlay of Catholic teaching and doctrine that I think limited them in some way.
What's an example of that?
Well, many of them, for example, felt it was blasphemous to actually enter a state of oneness with God, which in some way implies you're like God.
Huh, okay.
And so they would limit themselves to very deep, intimate, which is very joyful and blissful and productive, communion with God, second person relationship. They would sometimes, not all of them, but they would sometimes limit themselves to that second person experience of God and miss the first person experience of pure oneness. And, you know, in John 17, when Jesus talks about, I mean, it's his culminating prayer of his ministry, and he, you know, he prays that they, his disciples, would be one in him as he is one in the Father. I mean, he's actually teaching a doctrine of pure oneness. And then when you see the crucifixion as the ultimate symbol of non-attachment, right?
Yes, exactly.
So we're supposed to follow Jesus. Well, where is he going? He's headed to the cross. Oops. You know, why can't he go to the coffee shop? Holy cow. So, you know, he's going to the cross. Well, what's the symbolism there? The symbolism is I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm willing to surrender. I'm willing to let go of you know, the false sense of self, any attachments, any control that I have to what? To be able to open myself so fully that I can receive resurrection, the fullness of life, right? The fullness of divine life. You don't empty yourself out, you can't receive it. So, you know, the crucifixion very dramatically symbolizes that. The other thing about the early Christian mystics was this notion of dark night of the soul. I have no doubt that many have experienced that. I've talked to modern mystics who have had that experience. I never experienced a dark night of the soul. Mm-hmm. I experienced inner crucifixion. I experienced inner surrender to my false sense of self, to my personal attachments and needs and desires and, you know, so forth. But for me, the path was always, you know, accepting the personal frustrations of stupidity and the and mucking up the practice.
Right, right.
For me, it was always a path of joyful expectation, unfolding, excitement, increasing joy and light and inner transformation. I just never had this sense. I had an experience one morning where I woke up in kind of a weird, you know, from this yogic perspective, when you're in deep sleep and you lose body identification,
right,
kind of in a state of super consciousness, but it's unconscious super consciousness. And the idea of yoga meditation practice is to have conscious, super conscious awareness.
Right.
And I woke up in this state one morning where there wasn't body identification and form identification, mental forms, emotional forms. I was just kind of completely expanded into the divine. And so I woke up in that state. I didn't shift into waking state. And I was just amazed at what I was experiencing. Well, you know, I looked over to the closet and saw my clothes, and my mind started thinking about, okay, what are you going to put on for work today? And once that process started, then my limited sense of self started to form up. And I literally watched my personality, needs, fears, desires, hopes, dreams, you know, form up. I mean, they all took form and became what I call the little Phil, mm-hmm. little Phil guy. And I laid there pondering that, having in front of me the expanded sense of self in wholeness, in oneness with the divine, and the little Phil guy with all of his needs and fears and responsibilities and so forth. And I thought, I started laughing because it was like, I'm afraid to give the little Phil guy up for this.
Right.
I mean, I thought, holy cow. At one level, it seems like you're being asked to give up everything that's important to you. But then when you catch the vision, it's laughable that what you're asked to surrender and what you're able to receive in terms of expansion of consciousness and the fullness of life, it's laughable.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that brings up this idea of trusting the development of the process, though. Because in my own experience, having been early on a very pessimistic individual, it was easy for me to say things like, okay, I can let go of that. I can let go of this, you know, this dream is not that important. It was easy for me to do that. But you know, as life goes on, it's as though there comes a point where you do have to say something like, I'm just going to let this go. And if a person has not had an experience like you have described, or if a person has not yet had a meditative experience where it is revealed sort of the difference between here's what you really are and here's the little thing that you think is so important that you need to let go, you know, how can someone maintain a sense of trust if they've not had that kind of experience, and yet they're being kind of asked, you know, for example, when I teach meditation, one of the things I say is you will have the most profound meditative experience possible the moment that you are able
to completely let go of that, that small, not false sense of self. But that's scary for some people. So how do you continue to encourage people when there's still that fear there and yet they've not had that kind of meditative experience?
Boy, really significant question. If all you have is a false sense of self, right, you're not going to give it up because it's all you've got. Mm-hmm. For me, I had a hard time giving up my old form of Christianity because it was all I had. It was what my life was wrapped around. It's what I was enmeshed in. To give it up meant I had no identity whatsoever. It felt like extinction. It was very fearful.
Right.
It was only when there was some opening of consciousness where I, number one, experienced to some degree the true nature, character, and presence of God, and the eternal nature of my own true self, my essential being, that then it was easy for me to give up my old form of Christianity because I had now had something else to hold on to.
Right.
Of course, if you hold too tight, you mess up the process. But for me, there had to be at least a glimpse of something deeper, something more profound, something more substantive, for me to have the faith to surrender the rest, you know, to just let go.
And that came through just going through the meditation procedures and the process. It developed naturally. Is that what you're?
I can remember a particular morning. I mean, I had these ideas of God in my head from theology, from church teaching. And sadly, for most Christians, you know, God's up there approving and disapproving, and he's blessing and he's punishing, very dualistic, very parental. And I wanted to experience God's love. I want to be accepted by God, but yet you have all this fear that you're not good enough or you're not doing the right thing, or, you know, you struggle with all of that.
Right.
I will never forget the morning when there was this opening in consciousness, and I had a direct experience of the presence, nature, and character of God. And it was an experience of pure acceptance, pure love. It was so soul nourishing and so significantly developmental, because at that moment I was able to put aside this false notion of God as kind of a superhuman up there, approving and disapproving, blessing and cursing.
Right. Okay, so with that in mind, when you look back, what do you think contributed to that possibility or that capacity for that to happen for you?
Well, I was well taught to meditate. I mean, I was well taught in how to meditate properly.
Good, okay.
And so I was able to enter a state of deep awareness where I could literally set aside the function of the mind, attachment to the body and the function of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I was open to an expanded awareness, an expanded realization of the nature of life, the nature of truth, the nature of God, the nature of myself. At first it's incremental. You have the experience. It's tremendously liberating. But then, you know, you stand up and you go to work and you're back into your old patterns.
Right.
And, you know, you're looking forward to your next meditation so you can have that expanded state. Well, the objective, of course, is to, I mean, ultimately, and I'm talking from kind of a Christian point of view, mystical Christian point of view, you're ultimately seeking inner purification, which means what? Your attachment to false sense of self, desires, fears, needs, possessions, roles.
Right.
You know, everything that you're attached to that gives you your sense of self, that starts to weaken,
right,
and starts to dissolve, and the attachment, that's a bad word, but your realization of the true sense of self begins to blossom, and that starts to become the core of your identity. And so that, you know, you enter the spiritual practice of learning how to integrate that with your day-to-day living.
Exactly. Well, earlier on, you know, you had mentioned that one of the difficulties you had in Christianity in your profession was a difficulty to see people changing, or not, people didn't necessarily seem to have the power to change their heart.
Right.
And, you know, I've, like you, I've been involved in teaching meditation for a number of years. And the thing that I've always wanted to try to focus on is what exactly is required such that they can have these experiences. And you described very well this ability to, when you're meditating, to put aside your attachments to your mind, body, personality, likes, dislikes, these sorts of things. And when I, when we had the Kriya Yoga Meditation Center in Asheville, I remember I once tried to give a lecture on, I believe it was in Vasistha's Yoga, where it says, oh, well, liberation is easy. All you have to do is give up your hopes, cravings, and desires. And I remember giving that lecture and everyone's eyes just glazed over. So, and I was told by the assistant minister at the time, yeah, probably don't pull that out. So in your experience, though, you said you were taught to meditate well, and I hear that. What was it in how you were taught that allowed you to understand and recognize, okay, if I'm going to do this well, I do need to be very engaged in the process of letting go of everything that's not, I guess, what I'm aiming to experience. How did you do that?
Well, again, foundationally, you know, mm-hmm. it was Jesus that said you find yourself by losing yourself, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now, that's not just a comment about service to other people.
Exactly.
That's a very profound spiritual teaching that you have to be willing to let go of your old sense of self to find your essence of being. Hmm. Well, how does that happen? For me, primarily in meditation, and meditation that, you know, you start with, for me, you start with concentration. So you're putting your attention on one point, whatever that point is. The body calms, the mind settles. And then, you know, that point that has allowed for this relaxation and this calmness and this stillness of body and mind is now an obstacle that's in the way. Mm-hmm. So then you learn to let go of that point of focus. You have a pure intent. I mean, you're not doing this for no reason. You have an intent to awaken to truth, to awaken to God, to awaken to your true nature. But it's not a work, it's not a driving intent that you're trying to make happen. You can't make it happen from the false sense of self because it's so limited and insubstantial. Mm-hmm. So you have to be willing to now, you know, the practice itself allows you to focus in a way where you can let go of body and mind, where you can let go of the patterns of thought and emotion that keep you limited and confined to a false sense of self. And then you let go of that point of focus so you can enter a state of pure silence, pure consciousness, pure awareness that then opens a space for deeper seeing, deeper realization, deeper awareness, mm-hmm. Expansion of consciousness, realization of things as they really are, and you let that unfold. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, once I started getting glimpses of, again, the true nature, character, and presence of God, and then to some degree my oneness with that, my essence of being as a ray of that, then it just became increasingly easier to let go of the false identifications and false sense of self.
Right. Yeah, it's that initial hump of fear, though, that I think a lot of people have.
I've had people... and this happened to me at one point. You get to that point where there's a shift in awareness, but somewhere you realize to go through that little spot in the hourglass, you know, that little point in the middle that's so narrow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Your attention's got you focused to that narrow spot. If you can get through it, then there's this huge expansion. But a lot of people sense that when this expansion, to move into this expansion, they got to let go of the old self. Well, if that's the only sense of self I have, it feels like, can feel like extinction. It's extremely frightening, and you pull back.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that I think of when it comes to situations like that, you know, that seems like a very scary thing to happen, letting go of the old sense of self through something like meditation. However, you know, you had mentioned how you got involved in meditation was essentially through a painful situation where you were trying to either heal pain or get away from pain. And, you know, there are plenty of experiences in life where people have those moments that they are then driven into trying to find something greater, understand something more because of an experience. You know, for example, after going through a year and a half of taking care of my wife, only to find that she was actually going to die, I remember meditating beside her and I was asking, why is this the case? And I was meditating right beside her in bed, and what boomed in my awareness was the words, "So you'll learn this isn't real." I mean, it was just like, it was, wow. It wasn't my voice. It was, "So you'll learn this isn't real." And of course I didn't want to hear that, but what I learned from that is, I feel it's important to try to encourage people, hey, maybe get beyond this fear of letting go of the small sense of self in this way, consciously through something like meditation, yoga practice, such that, you know, you don't have to go through something as traumatic, or when you do have to go through something as traumatic, you already have a foundation or a sense of understanding of what's really going on a bigger picture. So I'm just tying it back to this idea of how pain can drive you. You know, in a way, that little fear that people have in meditation, that's probably something that is good to seek out and work through rather than have it forced upon you through circumstance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Right.
It had to be forced on me. I'm grateful. I mean, I still have lingering debilities because of the injury, but they're reminders to me of the blessing of awakening. I mean,
yeah.
I wouldn't trade that for anything else.
Right.
But you know, the yoga scriptures are pretty clear. If you can avoid suffering, avoid it. You don't, right?
Yes. Well, and the non-attachment, the non-attachment is there. As you mentioned in the Bible, it is one of the clearest things that is stated in the Yoga Sutras. It's one of the clearest things that's stated in the Bhagavad Gita. There's another text, well, there's plenty of texts that go into it, but Ashtavakra Gita, you know, I remember reading a line that said something like, you know, for countless incarnations, you have been attached to children, wives, wealth, career. It gives this kind of list of things that you were attached to and how that didn't really help you, did it? You know, kind of encouraging to go beyond it.
Yeah, and we lack a good word in English for non-attachment. Non-attachment sounds like you're uncaring, aloof, not engaged.
Right.
And the truth is that your attachments actually limit your ability to love from the perspective of the fullness of divine love.
Right.
When you are able to let go of limited ideas, concepts, a sense of self, you know, attached to particular forms and so forth, your ability to engage in life, to engage in relationship, and to love others is actually increased. I mean, the path of non-attachment really is the path to expanded loving.
Right. And that becomes something that, and again, you are the expert in this situation related to biblical things. I mean, it seemed like Jesus was very much about essentially loving everyone equally. Is that accurate?
Love your enemy, right? He talked about how easy it is to love your friends. Well, what's the big deal there? Love your enemies, do you see? Mm-hmm. He wanted love to expand. I mean, why was he being criticized? He's associating with lower class, you know. Mm-hmm. He's associating with the ritually unclean and impure. I mean, that was scandalous in his time. So he was into loving life, creatures, creation, and certainly every human being, because every human being has divine nature within.
But it was also specific. It was also specific to the moment, right? Because wasn't there a line in there that says something about, I don't remember it exactly, but it was referencing, like, for example, if someone passes away, you know, their body is going to be burnt and then you move on. I mean, let the dead bury the dead, all these sorts of things. Is this what he was getting at about sort of being appropriate to those who are alive now in the moment and the experience you're having?
His kingdom. See, Christianity changed the notion of kingdom of God into a future place and a future event. He was completely against that. I did a presentation on the kingdom of God at a university some years ago at a mysticism conference, and my topic was the kingdom of God. And I studied every reference in the New Testament to kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven. What stunned me was that most of the references were present tense. And the ones that were in future tense because for some people, they're not going to awaken into the present until some point in the future. But his teaching was essentially the kingdom is present now. The kingdom is present today in its fullness. Mm-hmm. Don't look to the future. Don't look to the past, do you see?
Right.
Take no thought for the morrow. Whosoever puts his hand to the plow and looks back is not fit for the kingdom, because you can't find the kingdom in the past or in the future. It's here, it's now, it's in present moment, spiritual awareness and realization. He was a teacher and mediator of the present fullness of life. I came that they might have life more abundantly. Now, not some time in the future if you've done enough good things, you see?
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate form of non-attachment, isn't it?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, if you let go of attachments to past and future, well, hey, that's attachment to memory, to fear, to desire. Wow.
Yeah, well, And this is, you know, what I always found interesting was, you know, when you read the works of the Kriya Yoga teachers, you know, they speak to this, but they speak to it in a way that seems to be digestible to their current era of students.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's an important thing to remember, is that when you're learning this kind of information so that you can have the experience, it needs to be delivered in a way that's appropriate for the individual. There's a book, I think I already mentioned it, called Vasistha's Yoga. And there's a story in Vasistha's Yoga where these individuals are sent out into the woods to get firewood. That's what they think they're going for. They think they're going to go get firewood. And what they end up finding is these gems, the spiritual gems of awakening, essentially. And I always like that story because what it does is it tends to express this idea that when we get on the spiritual path, we think we're going to get this one idea. We're going to have this idea of oneness with Christ or yoga and samadhi, and our little minds at that point in time thinks we know what that is. But then as we walk on the path, as we practice the techniques, then we start to recognize what the truth of the matter is. So it's almost as if we go for one thing, but then we find out something totally different that we couldn't even imagine before.
Oh, absolutely. Because the mind is so limited in even in what it can imagine.
Right. Yes. Yes. I remember Mr. Davis telling a story one time about he went to dinner with a member of, I believe it was the meditation center in Phoenix, with the senior minister of that center. And the woman had a picture of a bearded man with the cosmos behind him. And she said, that's my master. Like he comes to me in visions or things of this nature. And she was a Kriya Yoga practitioner, and Roy wasn't quite sure what to do with that. And so he looked to Herbert, who was the senior minister, and Herbert shook his head not to say anything. And then later on, he ended up talking to Paramahansa Yogananda, and Yogananda said, it's good that you didn't say anything, because right now, that's what she needs in order to stay on this path. In time, her mind will outgrow that. But if you had come out right then and said, that's not true, there are no, this guy isn't there trying to awaken you, then she might have turned away or abandoned the path too soon. So I think it's important to recognize that in this process, we may have occasional things which aren't true, which help us eventually arrive at the actual truth.
Oh, I can remember the very first meditation that Roy led when I first attended a retreat at Center for Spiritual Awareness. And he started by saying, imagine God however he is real to you.
Right.
Well, inside I'm thinking, what? I mean, people have all sorts of weird ideas. let's just teach the correct thing and move on. Well, you know, he's practicing that wisdom that people have to have a touch point. They have to start where they are. And then, of course, he followed up by teaching that as your awareness deepens, as your consciousness expands, then the true nature of God and self are going to be unfolded or unveiled.
Right.
So, yeah, you start where you are. And if your practice is pure, if your intent is pure, then you're open to that unfolding. You're not clinging to a limited notion in the past.
Right. Well, I feel that we could go on for hours. And the notes that I have taken, I think I would like to talk to you a bit longer. But for the sake of the podcast and people's attention span, I would like to conclude this discussion with you with the question, with your relationship with Mr. Davis, you know, as your Kriya Yoga teacher, do you have any sense of what the most important, either a lesson he imparted to you or the most important thing that he taught you, you know, with that relationship that you had with him?
Oh, sure. I'll mention a few things. I loved Roy. A lot of people didn't connect with him because he seemed kind of abrupt and austere in many ways. I think he wanted people to be devoted to the spiritual path primarily and not to him.
Right.
And that was his way of kind of screening out people that weren't deeply interested. But number one, I've done a lot of reading. I've studied with a lot of good people. As far as I'm concerned, Roy had the most perfect balance of teaching between what I would call moral, mature, responsible, productive living, coupled with deep inner spiritual practice and realization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many religions tend to go the morality route. Some of the Eastern things go into deep realization, but they don't deal with the day-to-day living.
Mm-hmm.
Roy, as far as I'm concerned, had the absolutely best balance of bringing those two worlds together. You know, right living coupled with pure inner spiritual work.
Right.
So that staked out deeply in my mind and heart, his balance and his focus. I think his cautions on avoiding emotionalism, fantasy, sensationalism, really wise, because a lot of people who go into inner work get hindered and distracted by sensationalizing things or emotionalizing things, and they get lost in that. And he was always very skillful in keeping people on the path in a responsible way.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't deny what people might call dramatic spiritual experience, but he did not foster it and encourage reports of it. He wanted those things to be private. Because once you start expanding and sharing those sorts of things, the ego does take over and they tend to become sensationalized, and then it diverts you from the path.
Right.
I had three what I would consider to be dramatic spiritual experiences with him, and I kept trying to seek validation of him from him. And he would change the subject. One time he just turned and walked away from me.
Yeah.
And I was just so angry. And so after one retreat, I got home and I sent him an email and I said, look, I get it. I understand why you are this way. I understand your emphasis. I appreciate it. I've seen many examples of people going off the deep end when they over-dramatize and so forth. But the following things are true. And then I listed in detail these three experiences I had had with him. And, you know, I said, damn it, these things are true. And I listed. And I got back a two-word response from him, and it was, I know. That was it. That was all the validation I was going to get. And so he was, you know, about keeping the personal things personal.
Right.
And having a, you know, a pure practice. Roy lived with integrity and encouraged integrity within me. So I think in the end, what I appreciated the most was the balance in his teaching, which I found nowhere else. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, devoted, persistent, pure practice.
Right. Well, yes, I agree with all of those sentiments as well. thank you for sharing that. Well, I'm trying to think about, you know, in the future, there is no future, right? But I'm trying to think about in the future, how to even proceed. You know, we've covered so many good topics, and I'd been thinking about digging into the Bible. You know, as we mentioned in an email, it's been something I've been exploring a little more deeply and how it relates to yogic practice. So maybe, as time permits, we might be able to spend some time discussing these things that you've found that dovetail with Christianity, mysticism, and yogic practices. Does that sound like something you'd be interested in exploring with me on this channel, this Kriya Yoga podcast?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining me, Phil. It was really a pleasure to talk to you again. And I definitely look forward to speaking with you sometime soon. So thank you for being here.
No, I'm so grateful we've reconnected here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you have a good day, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
This episode of the Kriya Yoga podcast was made possible by donations from Kriya Yoga apprenticeship students and supporters of our Patreon community at www.patreon.com/KriyaYoga.